From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I don't know if you're aware of this, but we lead the world when it comes to dollars spent, millions of dollars spent on research about climate change. We want to know more about it. It's easier to solve a problem when you know a lot about it. And if you look at the statistics, you'll find the United States has taken the lead on this research.
The Bush administration has taken the lead on research into global warming to discredit it. We'll speak with Sierra Club Executive Director Carl Pope.
And after the Bush administration spent millions of dollars on research, they brought oil industry and lobbyists in to censor the research. And when they still didn't like the findings, they had the president announce these were all simply products of the bureaucracy.
We'll also take a look at reports. The White House environmental policy chief repeatedly edited government climate reports to play down links between greenhouse gas emissions and global warming. His previous job with the American Petroleum Institute. And we'll speak with Greenpeace about documents that reveal Bush's global climate policy was heavily influenced by ExxonMobil and other companies. Then we'll look at Link TV's Peabody-winning news show, Mosaic, World News from the Middle East.
To keep up with events in the Middle East, you can either watch corporate media or you can watch Mosaic, which is in essence a compilation of what 280 million people throughout the Middle East watch on a daily basis in 22 countries. It's the stories as reported there, unedited and unfiltered.
But first, a debate on USA Patriot Act 2. It's just been passed behind closed doors by the Senate Intelligence Committee. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Tensions remain high in Latin America's poorest country, Bolivia. Some fear the situation could rapidly deteriorate into a bloodbath. Today, the Bolivian Congress will attempt to convene to decide who will govern the country following the resignation earlier this week of President Carlos Mesa. He stepped down amid massive protests led by groups representing the country's majority indigenous population. The protests have shut down large areas of the country and have been the largest in the political capital, La Paz. The situation is so volatile there, the Congress has been unable to convene, and so lawmakers are headed to the historical capital of Sucre to hold emergency meetings today. The outgoing president, Mesa, is warning the country may be on the brink of a civil war. In an unusual move, Mesa publicly called on the right-wing president of the Bolivian Senate to waive his constitutional right to succeed Mesa. But that politician, Armando Vaca-Diaz, has made clear he does not intend to do that and has warned if the demonstrators oppose him, there could be a bloodbath. The right-wing Vaca-Diaz has also hinted he may declare martial law in a statement that has worried many. He said, quote, "I'm absolutely convinced the armed forces will back us." Meanwhile, veteran Bolivia analyst Jim Schultz of the Democracy Center in Cochabamba is reporting his sources are telling him the U.S. Embassy is now in talks with Vaca-Diaz, helping to pave the way for his taking over the presidency. He also reports just before Mesa resigned earlier this week, he met with the U.S. ambassador. Schultz writes, quote, "Vaca-Diaz is a close ally of the deposed and reviled ex-president Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada. He comes from Santa Cruz, the region whose demands for autonomy have helped spark this crisis. He's an opponent of returning the country's gas and oil to public hands." Schultz goes on to write, "Vaca-Diaz has also called chillingly for Mesa to govern again," shorthand for using the military to crush protests. Meanwhile, Bolivia's indigenous groups, labor unions, agricultural workers, and others who've poured into the streets and shut down Bolivia have vowed to resist Vaca-Diaz and say they will engage in civic resistance against police and army troops if the government attempts to impose martial law. Here's one of the country's leading opposition figures, Congressmember Evo Morales.
Y vengo fundamentalmente si Armando Vaca-Diaz es presidente y no renuncia la sociedad.
If Armando Vaca-Diaz becomes president, instead of rejecting the constitutional succession, we will call for a united and organized resistance to prevent the government of Armando Vaca-Diaz, who will only serve the interests of the transnationals. We will call for a civil disobedience in order to demand the respect of Bolivia.
Bolivian opposition leader Evo Morales, he's now calling for early elections to be held. Meanwhile, as Bolivia's future remains in the balance, the protests are continuing. 26 miners were injured when they were fired on by police, and the mayor of La Paz, Juan Del Granado, announced yesterday he's beginning a hunger strike to protest Vaca Díaz. Del Granado spoke to reporters yesterday.
Son más de 20 instituciones de nuestra querida ciudad, la ciudad de La Paz.
There are more than 20 institutions in La Paz that have started a hunger strike. And we are calling on all residents of the capital to join us in solidarity to say to the country and to Armando Vaca Díaz that he cannot succeed as president of the republic. He represents, sadly, the old way of thinking, and we Bolivians demand change. Renovation and transformation.
The mayor of La Paz, Juan Del Granado. The current crisis in Bolivia was sparked by massive popular resistance to foreign control of the country's energy resources. Bolivia has estimated natural gas reserves of more than 50 trillion cubic feet, second only to Venezuela in South America, according to the U.S. Energy Department figures. 26 foreign oil and gas companies have 70 licenses to operate in Bolivia. While control of natural resources is a central issue for the masses protesting in the streets, it's by no means the only one. At the heart of the protests are the rights of the country's indigenous communities, who they say want not just nationalization of the country's resources, but nationalization of the government and an end to the exclusion of indigenous Bolivians from the governing of the country. Now to the Downing Street memo. Coming on the heels of British Prime Minister Tony Blair's visit to Washington this week, momentum is building for a congressional investigation into new proof that the Bush administration deliberately misled Congress and the UN in the months leading up to the invasion and occupation of Iraq. The memo, as it's being called, is minutes of a meeting of Tony Blair's top advisors from July 2002, in which they make clear that U.S. officials have told them the war was a foregone conclusion and that the U.S. had begun escalating its attacks against Iraq, essentially beginning the air war months before UN or Congress voted on the issue. Earlier this week, Bush was finally asked about it, despite the fact the memo was published more than a month ago by the Sunday Times of London. Here's what Bush said Tuesday when he and Tony Blair held a joint news conference.
You know, I read kind of the characterizations of the memo, particularly when they dropped it out in the middle of his race. I'm not sure who they dropped it out is, but I'm not suggesting that you all dropped it out there. Somebody said, well, you know, we had made up our mind to go to use military force to deal with Saddam. There's nothing farther from the truth. My conversations with the prime minister was, how could we do this peacefully? What could we do? And it's this meeting, you know, evidently that took place in London, happened before we even went to the United Nations, or I went to the United Nations. And so it's, both of us didn't want to use our military. Nobody wants to commit military into combat. It's the last option.
President Bush speaking on Tuesday. Yesterday, Senator Ted Kennedy became the first senator to raise the issue of the Downing Street memo in the Senate. In a statement, Kennedy said, quote, "The contents of the Downing Street minutes confirm the Bush administration was determined to go to war in Iraq, regardless of whether there was any credible justification for doing so." Kennedy went on to say the administration distorted and misrepresented the intelligence in its attempt to link Saddam Hussein with the terrorists of 9/11 and Osama bin Laden and with weapons of mass destruction that Iraq did not have. Senator Kennedy continued, "The Downing Street minutes also confirm what's long been obvious, that the timing of the war was linked to the 2002 congressional elections and that the administration's planning for post-war Iraq was incompetent in all its aspects. The current continuing crisis is a direct result of that incompetence," said Senator Kennedy. Meanwhile, a spokesperson for the other Massachusetts senator, John Kerry, also addressed the issue. In a statement to the Boston Phoenix newspaper, Seti Warren said, quote, quote, "Senator Kerry believes every American deserves a thorough explanation of the Downing Street memo. The administration and the Washington Republicans who control Congress insult Americans by refusing to answer even the most basic questions raised in this memo about pre-war intelligence and planning for the aftermath of war. That's unacceptable, especially with the lives of America's sons and daughters on the line. John Kerry will demand answers in the Senate. Stay tuned," said his spokesperson. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan reported to the Security Council yesterday many of the 6,000 prisoners detained by U.S.-led forces in Iraq are being held in violation of the Geneva Conventions. Annan's report read in part, quote, "Prolonged detention without access to lawyers and courts is prohibited under international law, including during states of emergency." While the Fourth Geneva Convention allows occupying forces to detain individuals, there's no provision allowing internment after an occupation has officially ended. Iraqi rebel forces killed four U.S. soldiers in separate attacks yesterday. In Afghanistan, Taliban forces claimed responsibility for killing two U.S. soldiers and wounding eight. The attack, using mortars to fire on a grounded helicopter, was the first of its kind in 3 years. This comes as the U.S. military falls short in its recruiting goals for the fourth month in a row. The Army lowered its recruiting target for May, but still came up 25% short. Meanwhile, the divorce rate among Army officers nearly tripled between 2002 and 2004. One of the key figures in the overthrow of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide in February 2004 has returned to Haiti. U.S. Assistant Secretary for the Bureau of Western Hemisphere Affairs, Roger Noriega, was in Haiti for a 24-hour visit. As he arrived, the U.S. Ambassador, James Foley, said Washington is working on a plan that will allow Haiti to buy more weapons. Foley said the U.S. was finding ways to work around the 14-year-old arms embargo that the U.S. imposed on Haiti. Human rights groups blasted the move, saying the Haitian police and reconstituted army have carried out summary executions and other violence against Aristide supporters. During his time in office, Aristide has disbanded the Haitian armed forces, which he said had become death squads. Ethiopian security forces shot and killed at least 22 people yesterday during protests accusing the ruling party of fraud in last month's still inconclusive elections. Taxi drivers, shop owners went on strike yesterday, joining a protest initiated by students on Monday. And the U.S. Senate yesterday confirmed Janice Brown to the U.S. Court of Appeals. The judicial filibuster ended in a compromise late last month, giving Bush nominees clear passage through the Senate. Samir Gibran here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of you in broadcast land and listening in on the internet.
Well, Juan, here in New York, a major victory for anti-stadium activists. You've been writing about this extensively.
Yes, I'd written, I guess, about a dozen columns over the last year or so opposing this boondoggle of a stadium that Mayor Bloomberg and the governor of New York, Governor Pataki, had been trying to put in a $2.2 billion football stadium that would also be the centerpiece of an Olympic bid of the city's the most expensive stadium ever built, with the biggest public subsidy ever imagined, estimated between $600 million and $1 billion. Everyone thought it was going to go through, except the people in the community who fought against it and many activists. And as a result of the massive opposition, finally, the State Assembly, a committee of the State Assembly and the State Senate, the Public Authorities Control Board, vetoed it and have killed the stadium for now.
Mm. also meaning that more attention will be paid to developing downtown, the area where the September 11th attacks took place.
Right, and hopefully dealing with bigger problems like the public schools and teachers, paying teachers properly, and police and firemen and so forth. Well, we're going to move on to our first segment. The Senate Intelligence Committee voted 11-4 in a closed-door session on Tuesday to approve an expansion of the USA Patriot Act. The new measure would make permanent 8 provisions of the act, which is set to expire at the end of this year. It would also increase government surveillance powers by granting investigators access to an individual's business records and allowing wiretaps and searches without a demonstrated link to terrorism or a federal judge's permission.
The legislation must still be considered by the Senate Judiciary Committee, the full Senate, and the House before it becomes law. Today, we'll have a debate on the USA Patriot Act. We're joined on the phone by Assistant U.S. Attorney for the District of Maryland, Harvey Eisenberg. He recently co-authored an editorial in the Baltimore Sun supporting the Patriot Act. David Cole also joins us, professor at Georgetown Law School and author of Enemy Aliens, Double Standards, and Constitutional Freedom in the War on Terrorism. He has an article in The Nation magazine last month titled The Missing Patriot Debate. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! David Cole, can you talk about what's just been passed behind closed doors by the Senate Intelligence Committee?
Well, the Intelligence Committee has voted to make several provisions of the Patriot Act permanent, some of the provisions that are most in controversy in other committees and among other members of Congress. And it's also voted to expand the powers that the government has, most significantly by giving the FBI the power to issue administrative subpoenas, which means that they can demand that the recipient of the subpoena turn over documents to them without having a grand jury, without having impaneled a grand jury for a criminal investigation, and without going before a judge and showing that there's any basis for the subpoena. So that's probably the most troubling aspect, but I think the broader problem is that very little of the most troubling provisions of the Patriot Act are even being discussed in the hearings that have been held thus far in Congress.
We're also joined by Harry Eisenberg, Assistant U.S. Attorney in the District of Maryland. The original Patriot Act, how successful do you think it has been, and why do you think there's been such widespread opposition? About 370 towns and municipalities around the country have passed resolutions against it.
First of all, good morning, and thank you all for inviting me to participate. Regarding the 370 towns, I can't speak to what individual town councils, city councils do. In my opinion, as a career federal prosecutor, not a political appointee, the Patriot Act has been beneficial to law enforcement generally in preventing the next act of terrorism. Certainly several terrorism acts have been tried, and they've been frustrated for many reasons. I'm not going to say it was exclusively because of the Patriot Act. That would be wrong and misleading, something I sometimes accuse my adversaries of dealing with the law and not giving all the facts. Regarding the town councils, I really can't say why they do what they do. I'm hoping that it's only because they really haven't studied the law well enough and know the peculiarities of what we need to deal with in this age.
So then, David Cole, what are your concerns?
Well, I think the reason that 370 cities and towns, including almost all the major cities and biggest cities in the country, 6 states have passed these resolutions is not because they're ignorant or don't understand the fact, but because they're very concerned by the way in which this administration has proceeded in the war on terror. And the Patriot Act is sort of the perfect example of it because it was done in incredible haste. It was done with very little, if any, respect for the civil liberties and civil rights concerns that are always in the balance when you're seeking to increase national security. So I think the Patriot Act is a symbol of a much broader phenomenon, the same phenomenon that sees the administration asserting the right to lock up people without charges based on the president's say-so as enemy combatants, the same phenomenon that sees the military using coercive interrogation tactics up to and including torture and homicide in interrogating suspects in the war on terror. And The Patriot Act is just one example. But within the Patriot Act, I think the most troubling provisions are those directed at foreign nationals, which allow the government to deport foreign nationals for their otherwise innocent associations with any group that the Attorney General doesn't like, that allow the government to keep out foreign nationals based on pure speech, that allow the Attorney General to lock up foreign nationals without showing that they've committed a crime and without showing that they actually are dangerous. Other provisions make it a crime for people to provide expert advice to any group that has been designated a terrorist group. That criminalizes pure speech. It doesn't matter whether the advice is to stop engaging in terrorism and pursue lawful means. It's still a crime. Another provision gives the government the power to freeze the assets of any entity in the United States without showing that it violated any law. And then if the entity goes in and challenges the freeze order in court, the Patriot Act allows the government to defend its actions using secret evidence that the entity has no opportunity to see or confront. And over a half dozen Muslim charities across the country have been closed down. Some of them might well have been funneling money to terrorist organizations, but we'll never know because the procedure doesn't provide for any open adversarial testing of the government's charges.
Harvey Eisenberg, what about some of the issues raised, especially the foreign nationals? To what degree is this much different from the old Palmer raids of the 1920s that were directed against immigrants at that time also when the country was facing what it believed to be a threat from socialists or anarchists?
Well, in the first place, let me specify again, I'm not a political appointee. I'm sworn to uphold the Constitution. And I respect just what Mr. Cole has said, although I disagree with some of his characterizations. I don't believe as a federal prosecutor worth his or her salt that would look at a material support of terrorism case and base that accusation upon someone going in and giving expert assistance and advice to not conduct terrorist activity. In fact, that wouldn't even be, it would be laughed out of court, it would be laughed out of the Justice Department. So I'd rather deal with actualities rather than, pardon me, but absurd hypotheticals that don't apply to the law or at least how we're implementing the law. With regard to the policing of our borders, that's a contentious issue. That one is best dealt with in Congress, and I, again, am not a legislator, and I think I'd be going outside the bounds of what we do. I can tell you for a fact that here in Maryland, I know of no such circumstance, and that we're just simply picking out foreign nationals for discriminatory purposes. There's a basis for why we police our borders at a certain time and place. We've always done it. Is it possible that someone, someplace, sometime will go overboard? Yes. Is it also much more likely that the system will correct itself through the judges, through the Congress, through all kinds of public opinions, through debates such as this? We're a democracy. There's a self-correcting activity involved in this great land of ours.
Final question. This latest bill involving the without getting a subpoena or a court order, going to a judge or a grand jury, David Cole, being able to look at an individual's health records, wealth records, their finances, gun records, among other issues.
Now, this is very, very troubling, and it's one of the things that the administration has been seeking for some time, they're pushing for it, and unless there's a significant opposition voiced, they'll get it. So I think it's absolutely critical that listeners, call their congresspeople and say we're opposed to, making the Patriot Act permanent, and particularly opposed to the administrative subpoena provision, which expands the Patriot Act. If I could just say one thing, Amy, about this absurd hypothetical that I raised. It's not an absurd hypothetical. I represent a group called the Humanitarian Law Project, which is a human rights organization in Los Angeles who has been providing human rights advocacy training to a Kurdish group in Turkey until that group in Turkey was designated a terrorist group. And then it became a crime for my clients, a human rights group here, to urge the Kurds in Turkey to pursue human rights avenues to resolve their disputes with the Turks rather than violence. And we brought a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of that provision of the Patriot Act, and we're successful. But the government didn't argue, oh, we would never prosecute these people, oh, this is frivolous, this is an absurd hypothetical. No, in fact, what the government argued was we have every right to prosecute this human rights group for providing human rights advocacy training to the Kurdistan Workers' Party of Turkey. So these are not absurd hypotheticals that I'm raising. These are actual provisions of the law that have been enforced, that the government has argued it can enforce against people who are advocating merely human rights.
For full disclosure, you should know that administrative subpoena power has been with the FBI in organized crime and in drug investigations for certainly more than a decade, and it's no different. You can make a valid argument that if it's good for organized crime investigations and drug investigations, that's certainly good for terrorism investigations.
David Cole.
Well, no. In fact, the administrative subpoena powers that exist today are very limited, involve very specific kind of regulatory schemes. They are not for general criminal investigation.
We're going to leave it there. David Cole, professor at Georgetown Law School, author of the book Enemy Aliens, and Harvey Eisenberg, assistant U.S. attorney in the District of Maryland, co-authored a piece in the Baltimore Sun supporting the Patriot Act. Thanks both for being with us. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Someone is watching you, so be careful what you do. They have been rising you, see, 'cause they're after you when you can't do no better. Set a better example and leave it to a sample. See, how can one man carry fire?
Michael Rose, someone is watching you here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we broadcast on over 330 radio and TV stations around the country, Pacifica stations, NPR radio stations, low-power FM stations, as well as on PBS and public access TV stations, and on both satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and 375 on DirecTV. We also video and audio stream at democracynow.org, and our closed caption for people who are deaf and hard of hearing, and are now doing our headlines in Spanish on our website at democracynow.org. Well, Juan, Tuesday, President Bush and Blair.
Yes. Well, President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair met at the White House in anticipation of the G8 summit in Scotland next month. Blair came to Washington with the goal of persuading Bush to increase efforts to address global climate change and curb greenhouse gases. So far, Bush has refused, calling only for voluntary measures to slow growth emissions through 2012. In 2001, President Bush withdrew U.S. support for the Kyoto Climate Change Agreement, claiming that it would hurt the nation's economy. At Tuesday's news conference, Bush defended his strategy to combat climate change.
Climate change. I've always said it's a serious long-term issue that needs to be dealt with. And my administration isn't waiting around to deal with the issue. We're acting. I don't know if you're aware of this, but we lead the world when it comes to dollars spent, millions of dollars spent on research about climate change. We want to know more about it. Easier to solve a problem when you know a lot about it. And if you look at the statistics, you'll find the United States has taken the lead on this research.
That was President Bush speaking at Tuesday's news conference. Yesterday, the New York Times reported a White House official who once led the oil industry's fight against limits on greenhouse gases repeatedly edited government climate reports in ways that play down links between such emissions and global warming. The official, Philip Cooney, is chief of staff for the White House Council on Environmental Quality. Before coming to the White House in 2001, he was a lobbyist at the American Petroleum Institute. The Bush administration today defended Cooney's participation. At his morning briefing for reporters, White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan said Cooney's reports were, quote, scientifically sound. And the Guardian of London has reported that the environmental group Greenpeace obtained documents which showed President Bush's global climate policy was heavily influenced by ExxonMobil and other oil companies. The article states in briefing papers given to U.S. Undersecretary of State Paula Dobrianski between 2001 and 2004, quote, the administration is found thanking Exxon executives for the company's active involvement in helping to determine climate change policy and also seeking its advice on what climate change policies the company might find acceptable. Joining us in our studio in Washington, Kurt Davies, research director for Greenpeace here in New York. We're joined by the executive director of the Sierra Club, Carl Pope. We welcome you both. Let's first go to Washington, to Kurt Davies, to talk about the memo that you got a hold of that's on your website from Exxon that is sent to Cooney in the White House. Describe its significance.
We obtained through the Freedom of Information Act a memo that in the wake of one of these controversial EPA reports, there was a report put out by the EPA in 2002 that basically said climate change is real, an urgent problem. There are many problems that will happen because of it. And Bush called it a memo from the bureaucracy. He downplayed it. But there was a firestorm within the White House because no one edited that. No one took it out of the EPA's hands. And Phil Cooney was the person who was in charge of that. What we uncovered was a memo he had apparently called the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a libertarian think tank that's heavily funded by ExxonMobil, and asked for help in the PR battle. And this letter is back from Myron Ebel, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, to Phil Cooney saying, thanks for asking for help. Somebody has to be fired. They were gunning for Whitman to be fired over this. And, of course, that didn't happen. She quit later. But that you can check that memo out on our website at greenpeaceusa.org.
We actually asked Mr. Bell if he could join us, but he wasn't able to join us today. Carl Pope, the significance of this.
Well, I think what it reveals is that this administration is determined to postpone action on global warming as long as it possibly can. Remarkably enough, we're about to pass, or the Senate is at least considering passing, I hope they don't, an energy bill which the administration admits will raise gasoline prices and increase imported oil. They're doing this in spite of the fact that ExxonMobil announced quietly last week that they recognize that the world is going to run out of oil, which means that what we're paying at the pump today is a fraction of what we'll be paying in 10 years unless we do something to change our energy policy. But this administration from the very beginning has worked actively with people like the Competitive Enterprise Institute, like ExxonMobil, to suppress government science. They've taken reports off websites.
Well, ExxonMobil funds the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
And ExxonMobil, yes, this is what one would colloquially describe as a conspiracy. Except I guess the government can't conspire. But if this was anybody but the government doing it, you would describe this as a conspiracy to prevent us from hooking our dependence on oil until it's too late. Until it's too late for the climate, until it's too late for our national security, which some young men and women in Iraq might say is already today too late for our security, and until it's too late to take action for our economy. So we are being put at risk by really something that is unprecedented. The government is not working for the public interest. The government is working for the private interest of one industry, which perhaps coincidentally is the primary financial support of the political party that runs the government.
Well, Carl, the revelations in the New York Times yesterday about another official from the Council on Environmental Quality of the White House editing out scientific statements that might indicate the tremendous impact that global warming is having. It reminds me of another official, James Connaughton, who was doing the same thing over the Ground Zero environmental issues at when EPA was issuing its releases. He also was editing them to downplay risks to the public. So this seems to be the Council on Environmental Quality's job within the Bush administration to keep information information from the public.
I think that's correct. And in fact, one of the things that's striking is that many of these stories that are now breaking have actually been on the public record for several years. But in the wake of the attack on the World Trade Center and the invasion of Iraq, the media were simply afraid to touch the stories. This document which Greenpeace has posted, you know, they actually released 2 years ago. I actually covered it in my book. The Attorney General of Connecticut protested it at the time. The mainstream media didn't say a peep because at that point we were fresh from victory in Baghdad.
And, of course, the resignation of Christy Whitman was an indication, as she has reluctantly but at least put out some criticism of the Bush administration's environmental policies, that this is an extreme view even within the Republican Party in terms of how to deal with the nation's environment.
Well, I think one of the remarkable things is that James McFarland, Robert McFarland, who was Ronald Reagan's national security advisor, has come out publicly and said that it is desperately overdue for us to do something about our dependence on oil. We have a huge number of extremely conservative voices in this country who were saying that if we really are serious about national security, we need to take action about our dependence on oil and about global warming. And the Bush administration is not only willing to ignore voices like the Sierra Clubs, they're willing to ignore voices from the national security establishment saying that the policy we are embarked upon is dangerous, reckless, and unwarranted.
Why is there a Department of Environmental Quality within the White House when you have the EPA?
The Council on Environmental Quality's function originally was to make sure that all government agencies honestly assessed and reported to the public before they took action what the environmental results of those actions would be. CEQ was put in place under Richard Nixon to be the government's watchdog on the honesty of whether or not government agencies were accurately telling the people what their actions would do. The Bush administration, and this is unprecedented, until this administration, that is the function CEQ played under administrations that I often agreed with and under administrations I often disagreed with. The Bush administration has turned CEQ from being a watchdog into being a censor.
Janice Brown just approved by the Senate yesterday, federal judge. Can you talk about her significance in terms of environmental issues?
Justice Brown believes that the Supreme Court, when it began in the 1930s, ruling that Congress had the right to protect the public from corporate pollution and other corporate harm, was wrong. Her jurisprudence really does not allow room for a role for the federal government in keeping Americans safe, in ensuring that the air they breathe, the water they drink, the communities in which they live are not polluted, contaminated, and poisoned by corporate irresponsibility. So putting Justice Brown on the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, which hears most of the critical cases about public health and pollution, is a very, very serious threat, both directly to our health and in a longer and perhaps more alarming way to the doctrine that it is the job of the federal government to protect us. Judge Brown really believes that for the federal government to keep us safe is to make us, in her words, slaves.
I'd like to ask Kurt Davies in Washington. You have been actively involved, Greenpeace, in both Democratic and Republican administrations in trying to affect their environmental policies. How would you rate the Bush administration in terms of past administrations around its efforts dealing with the environment?
Now they're a disaster. The worst part about it is they're very clever. You know, they name things like the Clear Skies and the Healthy Forest Initiative. You know, they have this Orwellian trick that they do to try to confuse the public. And on global warming, they've successfully crafted a plan that effectively is, you know, we're all on the party boat and the boat is sinking and they're telling us, hey, the water you're feeling on your feet might be a natural phenomenon, don't worry about it. We're putting some research into developing a bailer. Meanwhile, there's plenty of good ways to bail the water out now, and they're avoiding those. The key here is the science, and in global warming is the best case study of the impact of science on policy. And as you see, the actions of the CEQ trying to change the tone of the science, emphasize uncertainty. And they know from message testing and polling that people have a little bit, have questions about global warming. They're trying, and Exxon deliberately is trying. There was a memo revealed in 1998 that a deliberate plan of confusion by Exxon and the American Petroleum Institute to get people to question global warming warming and focus on the uncertainty. They know that if the public remains confused about it, if the public remains in a questioning state, unlike in Europe, there will be no political action. There is no urgency. Now, the biggest irony of all this is that the leadership right now is coming from the Republicans. You see Pataki in New York doing amazing things on renewable energy and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The Northeast states are suing utilities over it. You have Schwarzenegger announcing major cuts in greenhouse gases. And you have Senator McCain, who's putting forward the only viable bill on it, and he's going to go to the plate on it. This is, and he has nuclear power in that, which we totally disagree with, but on the face of it, he's battling Bush over global warming. So this is developed, we're at a tipping point right now, and you're going to see the Bush administration and companies like Exxon increasingly marginalized in that fight.
Finally, we just have 30 seconds, but Carl Pope, this quote of President Bush at his news conference on Tuesday, saying, I don't know if you are aware of this, but we lead the world when it comes to dollars spent, millions of dollars spent on research about climate change.
You can spend a lot of money on research, but if you let the oil industry censor the research after you complete it, and if you don't act on the findings, you might as well burn the money on the White House steps.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Kurt Davies of Greenpeace and Carl Pope, Executive Director of the Sierra Club and also co-author of the book Strategic Ignorance, Why the Bush Administration is Recklessly Destroying a Century of Environmental Progress. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be joined by some Arctic explorers. Didn't like what they found up north. Stay with us.
Oh, Mother Earth, with your fields of green, once more laid down by the hungry hand. How long can you give and not receive and feed this world?
Neil Young, Mother Earth, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, last month, two U.S. citizens attempted the first ever unsupported summer crossing of the Arctic Ocean in order to highlight the impacts of global warming. They join us now in our D.C. studio. Welcome to Lonnie Dupre and Eric Larson.
Thank
you.
Good morning.
Can you tell us what you found?
Well, I'll tell you, we were out on the ice for about 3 weeks, and we found a lot of broken sea ice, a lot of half a mile open cracks in the ice that we had to try to negotiate with our canoes, and found lots of polar bears as well.
Where did you start your journey, and how long did it take in total?
Yes, we started the journey on Cape Artishki in Siberia, and our attempt was to travel from there to the North Pole and then on to Canada. Purpose of the expedition, of course, to bring attention to global warming and show people how global warming's impacting the Arctic Ocean.
Eric Larson, can you talk about how you know whether it's global warming that is changing the environment?
Well, the changes that we saw were very unusual, and the breakup of the sea ice in the time that we were there was unseasonal. And so we can't 100% say for sure that that's directly related to global warming. However, we do know that the more of these events that happen, the more likely the cause is global warming.
Could you tell us a little bit more about what you saw?
Well, we saw a lot of ice and a lot of snow and a lot of water. We traveled starting out from Cape Artichesky in Siberia, trying to go north to the North Pole and eventually Canada, and we found pressure ridges that were towering to about 15 or 20 feet. We found a lot of deep snow, which was unusual. We found more leads, which were cracks in the ice with open water, and also brash ice, which is ice that's ground in between those leads, in the water as well, which made travel difficult. So we saw a lot of these conditions that were unusual, plus a very actually opposite drift of what's normal, and the drift is the direction of the movement of the ice. We wanted to be going north, with the normal drift of the ice being northwest. We actually ended up drifting southeast. At one point, we drifted 4 miles south or southeast of where we actually had started the expedition. So we were traveling on a conveyor belt of ice, waking up in the morning, traveling for 8 hours, and getting to setting up the tent at night and being further behind than when we started in the morning.
Eric Larson with Lonnie Dupre, Arctic Explorers. A final comment, Lonnie Dupre. You bring what message back to this country?
Well, yeah, the Arctic Ocean is basically the thermostat of the world, the air conditioning, so to speak, as well as Antarctica as well. And scientists are saying that by 2050, the Arctic Ocean could be ice-free, and therefore the polar bears would go extinct. The ice caps in Antarctica and Greenland would start to shrink and rise ocean levels and displace millions of people. So this is the global warming is a problem. We need to act now on it, not tomorrow, not the next day, but now.
Well, Lonnie Dupre, Eric Larson, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Arctic Explorers, with a message. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Earlier, I talked about the different outlets we broadcast on. Among them is Link TV, which is an independent TV channel that's on both TV satellite networks in the United States, on Dish Network Channel 9410, on DirecTV Channel 375. Well, since September 11th and the launch of the Bush administration's so-called War on Terror, another war has been fought worldwide. That's the information war. Never before in history have there been so many media outlets in the world. The global domination of massive networks like BBC, CNN has been challenged by networks like Arabic language satellite channels Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, and others, which reach tens of millions of homes across the world. These networks paint a very different picture of what's happening in Iraq, Palestine, Israel, and Afghanistan.
Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, has spearheaded an effort to create a Latin American network modeled after Al Jazeera called Telesur, while Al Jazeera is preparing to launch an English language network. While channels like Al Jazeera are known to many Americans, very few have ever watched a single minute of Al Jazeera or other Arab language broadcasts. Even still, many government officials and media pundits have somehow managed to develop strong opinions on the channel.
Well, there is a place people can turn daily to judge for themselves how the news is delivered in the Middle East. We're joined by Jamal Dajani, who is producer of the program Mosaic, World News from the Middle East. Mosaic's a daily show on Link TV, where we also broadcast, that compiles television news reports from throughout the Middle East. This year, Mosaic won one of journalism's highest honors, the Peabody Award. This is a clip from Mosaic.
As the aftershocks of the Iraq War continue to reverberate throughout the Middle East, many Americans are curious how developments in the region are being perceived by national leaders and people on the streets of Damascus, Beirut, Jerusalem, and Cairo. Four times per day, Mosaic, World News from the Middle East, brings you unfiltered news in English from over 15 national broadcasters throughout the region. See what over a quarter of a billion people in the Middle East are watching every day. Hear directly from their correspondents. and discover how they assess the current situation, not in short sound bites, but in complete unedited news reports. Get the whole picture. Watch Mosaic.
Yes, that Mosaic. Jamal Dajani joining us, director of Middle Eastern programming at Link TV, producer of Mosaic World News from the Middle East. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, congratulations on the Peabody Award. Talk about the idea behind Mosaic and how you gather this footage from newscasts around the Middle East.
Well, I mean, the idea was born after September 11 because what you see on corporate American media is basically sound bites. You don't get any real news coming out from the Middle East without the pundits telling their own spin around it. And so the idea was born in a sense that you have 280 million people living in 22 countries in the Middle East. The Middle East itself is not a monolith. You have over 130 different satellite stations currently operating out of the Middle East. So what we wanted to do is bring a window to what those folks out there are watching on a daily basis. And that's basically what Mosaic is all about.
How do you get it? How do you get these newscasts? I mean, you're not really digesting it. You're bringing excerpts of these reports from Lebanon TV, Jordan TV. Where do you get them from?
Many are available on satellite that we receive, just download from the satellite. Others, we have stories with shelf life. We ship over from our recording studio in Cairo. But basically, we have a small team, a hardworking team that monitor different stories on a daily basis. And in certain instances, we may have a show just going after one story and comparing how these different networks are reporting it, from Israel to the Lebanese broadcasting, to the Iraqis and so forth. And sometimes we are, of course, event-driven. So if you have something going on in Iraq, that's where our focus is going to be for that day.
And is the kind of programming that you are compiling, is it geared predominantly around issues in which the Arab world and let's say the United States or the West intersect, or do you also bring together some of the programming that deals with the domestic conditions in those countries as well?
Well, unfortunately, I mean, we do both. But unfortunately, with the events going on in Iraq, this is what has been dominating the news. I mean, we bring social, economical issues from time to time, or stories, that about women rights in Saudi Arabia or in Morocco and so forth. But the show is really driven with the facts on the ground. And recently, as you're all aware, even in the corporate media here, the big story is Iraq, or something happens in the Palestine-Israeli issue, and recently the events that were unfolding on the Lebanese front and in Syria. Those were what we have been focusing on.
Jamal Dajani, tell us the difference. So, for example, the latest killing of the anti-Syrian journalist when he put the key in the ignition of his car in Beirut, or, of course, just the latest developments in Iraq. What is different? Can you give us an example of a station that you're excerpting their newscast of?
Well, like you mentioned before, you said there is a war of information going on. And this is actually, there is a war of information going on between all these different networks. And it's driven by either sectarian or by the governments. For example, what you talked about, the killing of the journalists in Lebanon, you have a war going on between the Christian-sponsored station like LBC, and the Al-Manar, which is financed by Syria and Iran and the Hezbollah station there, basically putting the blame on each other. Whether this was, for example, the Hezbollah are saying that this is a conspiracy by the Mossad and the United States to create a civil war in Lebanon. And, of course, LBC is focusing on the Syrian involvement in silencing the people that are criticizing the government of Syria.
So you're saying no matter what country you go to, you find a similar pattern, which is the media in those countries, in one form or another, trying to advance a national interest or political interest. Do you find at the same time some those who are trying to dispassionately look at the facts and try to better inform their listeners?
Yeah, but I do believe like networks like Al Jazeera is really the address, you know, to get some kind of the truth. But we feel also by watching all these different networks, the truth emerges, which is also interesting. You're talking about all these different people or different countries trying to advance their points of view. The U.S. Also have joined this battle by launching Al Hurra right from Virginia here to somehow add another item on the menu of all these Arab viewers to watch the American propaganda machine. That's what they refer to it there.
So are you running Al Hurra as well?
Well, actually, we monitor Al Hurra, but believe it or not, Al Hurra is a one-way station. In other words, it's not permitted to be aired over the United States. So you are paying
because
to finance
it's propaganda.
It. Well, this is propaganda, but you are paying for it. The American taxpayer is paying for it, but is forbidden to watch it in the U.S. Which tell me, you know, what's the reason behind
that's
it?
That's also the case of Voice of America, because it was considered propaganda, okay, for others, but not for domestic consumption. So what is Al Hurra saying? What is the view that it is giving, that it is sending to the Arab world, for example, on the occupation?
Well, I mean, you said like the occupation, or is it liberation, and so forth. So there is definitely a twist on the way they're reporting things, that things are improving in Iraq. The election is a great thing that happened to Iraq. The Iraqis are free and liberated, and focusing more on the democratization while totally ignoring the agonies of the man on the street, the average Iraqi citizen, and the effects of the occupation on their daily lives.
You also, separate from Mosaic, have done a documentary, Occupied Minds, A Palestinian-Israeli Journey Beyond Hope and Despair. Can you talk about this?
Yeah, this is a documentary done with my partner and co-producer, David Michaelis, who is an Israeli. It's basically the journey of a Palestinian and Israeli going to the town they were both born. We were both born in Jerusalem in the same town, but we grew up worlds apart. And it's a perspective from the way we look at things, traveling together through the Palestinian territory, talking to Palestinians and to Israelis from the left and the right, and Occupied Minds is really about not just what goes on the ground as far as occupation, but it's really the mental occupation that both people are now suffering from. The Palestinians have suffered from the physical occupation, the mental occupation, but also the Israelis are suffering from the mental occupation. How to deal with the threats, the daily threats that they have to face, or to deal with the we interview a mother that have lost her son who was in the Israeli army. It is really a look at that fact of that people don't usually explore.
And if the theme is clearly that the land occupation has led to an occupied mind, do you reach conclusions as to whether both sides will have to liberate their minds first before they can deal with the land issue, or will the land issue have to be dealt with before the mental occupation can end?
I think people have to look beyond their noses. This is what, when just out of our experience being removed, even though we grew up there and we lived all our life, it gives an opportunity to look from a distance at the events there. And then when you talk to people, you feel they are all trapped in their own bubble of thinking. They cannot just move beyond thinking, how can we move further? How can we live in peace? How can we share the land? Everyone is trapped in their own thinking, whether from religious upbringing, or whether just from being indoctrinated all their life of one way or the other, thinking about fear and suspicion of the other.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Jamal Dajani, for joining us, Director of Middle Eastern Programming at Link TV, producer of Mosaic, winner of the Peabody Award this past year. Thank you.
Thank you.
And as we wrap up this program talking about the importance of independent media, wanted to send a shout out to KFCF in Fresno and the Central Valley in California, today celebrating its 30th anniversary. And also to a colleague of Juan and mine at WBAI, our dear friend Bernard White, who wraps up 13 years as morning show host on Wake Up Call at WBAI. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabel Caduce, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Maddie Harper, and Nell Geiser. DemocracyNow.org is our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.